In the magnificent Oscar-winning 2018 film, The Favourite, we see a tale based on a true story set in the court of Queen Anne, with two female courtiers vying to be the Queen's favourite. But almost 100 years before, we saw another tale of royal favourites, sexual exploits, and murder. In today's episode of the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast, we'll look at the story of King James I's favourite. Hi, and welcome back to the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I'm Steve, your host. And I'm happy to tell you that as the podcast goes, I'm in a bit of a happier place. Not with the subject matter, but for quite a while, I've been quite unhappy with my microphone, which was a condenser microphone, and it kind of picked up every bit of sound going. I bought a new one, and I can't tell you the difference it makes when it comes to editing. It really is night and day, and it's inspired me to get back and working on these episodes. And I'm also happy to tell you that in a few weeks' time, I'm going to be adding an extra layer to the podcast, subscriber-only episodes. So for those who don't mind paying less than half a cup of coffee if you were drinking it out, you could help support me, and I'll be giving you extra episodes every month. If that sounds like your kind of thing, keep tuned. But back to today's story, and it's been a while since I've actually touched on British history, so let's delve back into the 17th century. Just as Queen Anne would be the last of the Stuarts before the Georgian era, James I is the first of the Stuarts, having also succeeded the childless last of the Tudors, Elizabeth I. He had been James VI, King of Scotland since the age of one, and in 1603 oversaw the union of the Scottish and English crowns, and he became James I, although Scotland and England would remain independent sovereign states with separate parliaments and laws until the Act of the Union, which came into being in 1707, which saw the formation of Great Britain. And for this episode, I want to go a wee bit theatrical. Well, why not? Our story's set in Shakespeare's lifetime, so let us introduce the players. Let us go back to James I. He reigned over some of the most important years of Scottish and English history and remained Scotland's longest reigning king, clocking in 57 years on the Scottish throne. He married Anne of Denmark and had three children. Eldest son Henry Frederick died at 18 to typhoid. Elizabeth and Charles, who would go on to become Charles I on the death of his father. And with that, his royal duties were fulfilled, and we can delve a bit deeper into James's character. He was essentially a feeble man, given to bursting into tears. Moreover, he sometimes slobbered as he talked, and his legs were so weak that he often leaned on the shoulders of the people he was talking to. But with these matters of lineage sorted, he was homosexual, and he could indulge in his favourites, handsome young men who took the king's fancy. Next, we introduce Thomas Overbury, a poet and essayist, a man with a brilliant mind, but broody and prone to resentment. Overbury was born in Warwickshire in 1581. In 1595, he attended Queen's College, Oxford, and gained his degree in 1598, by which time he had already been admitted to study law in the Middle Temple in London. He soon found favour with Sir Robert Cecil, a statesman, and he travelled on the continent. Overbury was also homosexual. In 1601, whilst in Edinburgh, Overbury met a 14-year-old page to the Earl of Dunbar called Robert Carr. The tall, blonde, handsome and illiterate Carr was born in Somerset, and a bond quickly formed between the 20-year-old Overbury and the younger man. Evidently seduced by Overbury, Carr moved to London. Overbury became mentor, secretary and political advisor to his more charismatic friend, the brain behind Carr's steady rise to prominence in the court. By 1608, Overbury had been knighted. And luckily, or unluckily for Carr, he happened to break his leg at a jousting match, which just happened to have King James I in attendance. The king was smitten, and he took Carr under his wing and subsequently knighted him, also taking him into favour, discussing advice on such issues as dissolving Parliament. Needless to say that with such favouritism came with certain caveats. Carr was created the Viscount of Rochester and appointed a Privy Councillor, all guided by Sir Thomas Overbury. The tale takes a twist with the introduction of the bad guy, well, the bad girl in this case. This is Frances Howard, the daughter of Lord Thomas Howard. She'd been born in 1590, and when Robert Carr met her, she was married to Robert Devereux. However, I should explain they were married when she was aged 14 to the 13-year-old Robert Devereux, 3rd Earl of Essex. The marriage was primarily a political union, and due to both their young ages, they did not live together. Devereux was sent on grand tour from 1607 to 1609, apparently without having consummated the marriage. And a little bit of explanation. The grand tour was almost a historical relative of today's gap year, in which rich young men of rank took an educational tour of Europe, with Italy being the key destination. And it's certainly a subject that would be worth a history by episode. When Devereux returned, Frances made every effort to avoid him. She claimed that she was compliant with her marriage, but was, in fact, still a virgin. To say Lady Frances was a wee bit dangerous and mad would be putting it mildly. By this time she'd met and fallen in love with Robert Carr, and they wanted to marry. In Overbury, the wordsmith and Carr's former lover would write Carr's love letters to Frances despite disapproving of the match. Overbury described her as having the temperament of Lady Macbeth, that most cunning woman from the stage. And he didn't quite know how true this was. Unknown to Overbury, in order to rid herself of her husband, she'd approached a certain Mrs. Turner, a witch, who'd concocted love potions to ensnare Carr and obtain more powders to kill her husband. Mrs. Turner also wove spells aiming to make Devereux impotent. But before the plot could get stranger, Frances and Robert Devereux were allowed a divorce on the 25th of September 1613 on the grounds that the husband was impotent. And Devereux certainly dodged a bullet with the divorce. Despite the public ridicule Devereux faced that he couldn't get an erection for his wife, he claimed he was capable with other women, but was unable to consummate his own marriage. According to a friend, one morning, while chatting to a group of male companions, Devereux had stood up, lifted his nightshirt to show them his erection, proving, if nothing else, he was physically capable of arousal. When asked why she caused his failing, he claimed that she reviled him, abused, and miscalled him, terming him a cow, a coward, and a beast. Robert Carr and Frances were then to be married a few months later, on the 26th of December, 1613. But prior to the proposed marriage, Overbury had advised Carr not to marry Frances. And this was a mistake, for when she heard of this, the neurotic Frances had a new target for vengeance, and she wanted to rid the influence Overbury had over her husband. She tried to bribe a knight to murder Overbury, but he declined. So she persuaded Carr to plot against her enemy. Carr went to the king and suggested that Overbury should be made ambassador to France or Russia, and the king agreed. Carr then went to Overbury and advised him to refuse. Overbury allowed himself to be persuaded, and the king was infuriated by the refusal and ordered Overbury to be committed to the Tower, which is what Carr and his mistress had counted on. Overbury was now at Francis's mercy. Mother Turner was again called upon for poison. Overbury's keeper, Weston, was in charge of administering it via food. Sir Gervase Elves, a friend of Francis Howard, was made governor of the Tower. At first, he was ignorant of the poisoning, but when he learnt about it, he kept quiet. Overbury died on the 15th of September, 1613, aged 32, and no one was curious. And then, for Francis and Robert, all was bliss for the marriage, and they lived happily ever after. Yeah, sure, as if. In reality, 18 months later, in the summer of 1615, the true story came out. A Yorkshire apothecary's assistant confessed on his deathbed they had been paid £20 by the Countess of Essex to supply her with poisoning for murdering Overbury. James I's Secretary of State, Sir Ralph Winwood, brought the accusations to the King's attention in September, and James in turn urged his Privy Council to investigate the matter. It may be helped that James I had found a new favourite by this time. Confessions were extracted by torture, and the investigation and trial revealed that Francis had been surreptitiously poisoning Overbury for some time before his death by smuggling jellies and tarts into his chamber tainted with white arsenic and other toxic compounds. And the details spelled out, the Lieutenant of the Tower, Gervase Elves, admitted that he received a confession from Overbury's keeper, Richard Weston, that had been bribed by Francis to administer the poison. Elves intercepted the tainted sweets at one point and then took on the precaution of having Overbury's food prepared in his private kitchen and taking care to intercept any other food before it could reach Overbury. But he took no further action at this point. And Francis eventually succeeded in poisoning Overbury with a smuggled enema laced with mercury chloride. Overbury, probably as an after effect of the previous poisons ingested, had been vomiting and became quite ill. An enema, bypassing the digestive system, is still commonly used for certain medications. Francis and Robert Carr were arrested in October 1615. And the trial revealed that Francis had supplied the poison enema to Richard Weston, the jailer, through Mrs. Turner. Ilves was tried as an accessory, arrested and imprisoned for involvement. And between mid-October and December 1615, Ilves, Turner, Weston, and the apothecary James Franklin, who supplied the drugs, were all found guilty as accessories to murder and hanged at Tyburn. And the plot got thicker. Carr and his wife were tried in Westminster Hall, since they were of the peerage. Carr tried hard to put pressure on the king, and apparently he threatened to blurt out details of their relationship in court. And to this end, two men stood behind him with a cloak, ready to put it over his head if he made any such attempt. But the king had reassured him that he would not be executed. And although they were both sentenced to death, husband and wife were only confined in the tower. And by now, they hated each other and never spoke. They stayed in the Tower of London for 6 years before quietly being released to go and live in obscurity at their Chiswick country house. Francis died in 1632 at the age of 39 of cancer of the womb. Robert Carr, the former favourite, died in 1645 at the age of 58. King James would take on a new favourite, and his lover, George Villiers, the first Duke of Buckingham, who would also meet an untimely political assassination in 1628 at the hands of a disgruntled soldier, John Felton, who stabbed them as they were in the Greyhound Inn, Portsmouth. Buckingham had led a couple of disastrous campaigns which led to the deaths of many soldiers, many of disease, and it had made him a hated figure. James I died of a stroke in 1625 at the age of 58 years old. Well, that's it for another episode of the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I hope you enjoyed that one. And if you do, please like, subscribe, and see you next episode.